From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We are not giving up, obviously. We are going to fight on. This is the beginning of a longer struggle. I think everyone who has a sense that the United States needs to protect the Constitution at this time understands that struggle. And this case could be, I hope it will be, a wake-up call to all the citizens of this country and all the people who live here that you can't lock up the lawyers. You can't tell the lawyers how to do the job.
Defense attorney Lynn Stewart is found guilty on all five counts of aiding terrorism and lying to the government. She faces up to 35 years in prison. Today, Lynn Stewart and her attorney, Michael Tiger, join us in our Firehouse studio for their first national broadcast interview since the conviction. We'll also speak with one of the witnesses, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Veteran human rights attorney Lynn Stewart was convicted yesterday in a New York court of aiding terrorism by helping her client, the imprisoned blind sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, send messages to his followers. Rahman was found guilty in 1995 of conspiring to attack U.S. targets. He was serving a life term when Stewart was charged. Lynn Stewart was convicted of all five counts against her, including two terrorism charges that combined carry a maximum 15-year prison term. All five counts combined carry a maximum term of 35 years. The verdict has sent shockwaves through the legal community. Many analysts say it will have serious ramifications for the defense of people charged with terrorism because defense lawyers could be intimidated by fears they too could be charged with terrorism. Outside the court yesterday, Stewart was asked if she would do it all again.
I was asked that on the witness stand, whether I would, quote, do it again. And I had a moment because, of course, and the tears on my face are not for myself, but for my colleagues in the movement and my wonderful family and my 12, almost 13 grandchildren, and that I may be separated from them from the rest of my life, and that I feel so much that I have brought grief to people who didn't deserve to have grief. But I'd like to think I would do it again, because it was the right thing to do. It's the way a lawyer is supposed to behave.
Stewart's co-defendants, Ahmed Sattar and Mohammed Yousri, were also convicted on all counts. The trial lasted more than 7 months. The Manhattan federal jurors deliberated 13 days. We'll be joined by Lynn Stewart, her attorney Michael Tiger, and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark after headlines. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice warned North Korea to reconsider its choice to break off disarmament talks or face deepening isolation from the rest of the world and greater suffering for its people. Rice was responding to North Korea's announcement that it's built nuclear weapons and was abandoning the talks.
The fact is that we have for some time taken account of the capacity of the North Koreans to perhaps have a few nuclear weapons. There is no definitive, I can't go into the intelligence here, but there's no definitive answer to how many. But this has been since the mid-90s that the United States has assumed that the North Koreans could make such steps. But the fact of the matter is that the world has given them a way out.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Some analysts say the North Korean move was aimed at extracting concessions from Washington before any reconvening of the nuclear talks among the United States, two Koreas, Japan, Russia, and China. A month after President Bush warned that the United States hasn't ruled out military action against Iran, President Mohammad Khatami responded on Thursday that his country would turn into a scorching hell for any possible attackers. Khatami's comments were made at a rally of tens of thousands gathered on a snowy square in Tehran to mark the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Last week, Bush accused Iran of being the world's primary state sponsor of terror. Last month, Bush said his administration won't rule out using military force against Iran over its nuclear program. Despite the rhetoric between Washington and Tehran, Iran signaled yesterday it could reach a deal with European Union negotiators on its nuclear program. Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas dismissed three security commanders yesterday after a Hamas mortar barrage of Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip just 2 days after the ceasefire declaration. Among the commanders was the head of public safety in the occupied territories. 8 months before the September 11th attacks, the White House's then counterterrorism advisor, Richard Clark, urged then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to hold a high-level meeting on the al-Qaeda network, this according to a memo dated January 25, 2001, that was made public yesterday. Clark left the White House in 2003 and accused the Bush White House of having ignored al-Qaeda's threats before September 11th. Clark testified before inquiry panels and in a book that Rice, his boss at the time, had been warned of the threat. But in a 2004 column in the Washington Post, Rice wrote, quote, "No al-Qaeda threat was turned over to the new administration." The memo was released by the National Security Archive, an independent group that solicits government documents for public review. Germany's federal prosecutor has rejected calls to investigate allegations that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was guilty of war crimes over the Iraq prisoner abuse scandal. The Center for Constitutional Rights and four Iraqis who say they were abused by U.S. soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison filed the criminal complaint in Germany in November. The case was filed under a 2002 German law allowing for the prosecution of human rights abuses and war crimes, regardless of where they occur. The Senate approved a measure Thursday that gives greater protection to corporations from major class action lawsuits like the ones that have been brought against tobacco companies, giving President Bush the first legislative victory of his second term. The legislation was long sought by big business and would mean that large multi-state class action lawsuits could no longer be heard in small state courts. Such courts have handed out multi-million dollar verdicts. Instead, the cases would be heard by federal judges who have not proven as open to those types of lawsuits. The Senate passed the bill 72-26. It now goes to the House. The Association of Trial Lawyers of America said insurance, tobacco, drug, chemical, and other companies had financed the push to get the legislation through the Senate. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives passed legislation yesterday setting federal standards for state driver's licenses and rules to make it more difficult for immigrants to claim asylum. The legislation also calls for the completion of a border fence in California and more leeway for judges in deporting suspected terrorists. All the bill's provisions were approved by the House last year and were removed during negotiations with the U.S. Senate. State and local governments oppose the bill's provisions on driver's licenses. In a letter to lawmakers, the National Association of Governors objected to a requirement that states verify the identity of immigrants applying for licenses. The bill will likely be attached to legislation funding the war in Iraq to force the Senate to consider it soon. The White House is facing fresh accusations of a clandestine propaganda campaign after it emerged this week that it granted regular access to a right-wing blogger with a habit of asking President Bush easy questions. Jeff Gannon, who represented a right-wing site owned by a Texas-based Republican activist, had been a regular at White House briefings since 2003. But he aroused reporters' suspicions after posing ideologically loaded questions. The fake White House correspondent quit his job at the Talon News site on Wednesday after bloggers found he'd been operating under a pseudonym that he was linked to several gay pornographic web domain addresses under his real identity, James Guckert. Websites such as hotmilitarystud.com and militaryescorts.com are registered to the same owner as Gannon's website, jeffgannon.com. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan has dismissed the charges that Gannon was part of an underground propaganda effort as, quote, just a wild conspiracy theory. But questions remain about why the White House suspended the normally rigorous vetting process to issue daily passes to an organization rejected by the Senate last year for not being a legitimate media outlet. The extent of Gannon's links to an earlier White House scandal, the leaking of the name of the CIA operative Valerie Plame, also remain unclear. Gannon has been targeted for questioning in that case. Gannon's unmasking comes only weeks after the Bush administration admitted paying handsome sums to three conservative commentators to promote its social programs in print, radio, and television. Air America host Al Franken announced yesterday he is not running for the U.S. Senate. There had been speculation that Franken would run in his native Minnesota. Franken made the announcement yesterday on his radio program. And the community media movement has lost one of its most prominent activists this week. Dirk Koenig died on Wednesday during a medical procedure in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was director of the Grand Rapids Community Media Center for more than 20 years. He was 48. Dirk Koenig dedicated his life to building community media and traveled across the United States and the world to further that mission. Upper Peninsula. Sufjan Stevens here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and those catching us streaming on democracynow.org.
Well, civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart was found guilty on all five counts of aiding terrorists and lying to the government Thursday in a case that reverberated with defense lawyers around the country. Stewart was convicted of smuggling out messages from her jailed client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh. He's serving a life sentence on terror-related charges. Most notably, Lynn Stewart was convicted of helping Rahman contact followers in Egypt with messages that could have ended a ceasefire there and ignited violence. She faces up to 35 years in prison. Lynn Stewart's co-defendants, Ahmed Sattar, a postal worker who acted as a paralegal for Abdulrahman, and Mohammed Yusri, an Arabic translator, were also convicted of all charges against them. The verdict was a major victory for the Justice Department, one of the country's most closely watched cases since the September 11th attacks. Lynn Stewart's indictment in April 2002 was personally announced by Attorney General John Ashcroft. It was the first time the federal government has prosecuted a defense attorney in a terrorism case. Lawyers around the country fear the government's aim is to discourage them from representing unpopular clients. Yesterday's guilty verdict was hailed by Ashcroft's successor, Alberto Gonzalez, who said the convictions, quote, send a clear, unmistakable message that this department will pursue both those who carry out acts of terrorism and those who assist them with their murderous goals. The seven-month trial was held in the same New York federal courthouse where the Rosenbergs were tried for conspiracy to commit espionage more than a half century ago. It featured very few witnesses, as the government's case was based primarily on transcripts from more than 85,000 secretly recorded audio and video clips of meetings between Lynn Stewart and her client, as well as the home phone of Ahmed Abdel Sattar. The jury deliberated for 13 days before delivering a sweeping guilty verdict. Judge John Codel said set the sentencing for July 15th. Because Stewart was convicted of a felony, she'll be immediately disbarred. She remains free on bail but cannot travel outside New York State. After the verdict was read out, Lynn Stewart emerged from the courthouse with her husband and spoke to reporters gathered outside.
I'm still very shook up and surprised and disappointed that the jury didn't see what we saw. But I think, as one of my counsel put it, when you put Osama bin Laden in a courtroom and ask the jury to ignore it, that's asking a lot. We are not giving up, obviously. We are going to fight on. This is the beginning of a longer struggle. I think everyone who has a sense that the United States needs to protect the Constitution at this time understands that struggle. And this case could be, I hope it will be, a wake-up call to all the citizens of this country and all the people who live here that you can't lock up the lawyers. You can't tell the lawyers how to do the job. You've got to let them operate. And I will fight on. I'm not giving up. I know I committed no crime. I know what I did was right. Thank you.
Lynn Stewart speaking outside the courthouse yesterday. She joins us today in our firehouse studio just blocks away from where she was tried. We're also joined by her lawyer, Michael Tiger, as well as former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who testified in the Lynn Stewart trial. He also was recently named as one of Saddam Hussein's attorneys. And we welcome them all to Democracy Now! Juan?
Lynn, obviously everyone was stunned by the verdict, and most people figured that as the jury continued to deliberate for so many days, that there was a greater likelihood that they would find acquittal, at least on some of the charges. Your response now that you've had a full day to think about it and what happened in the courtroom in terms of the jury's deliberations?
Well, we definitely felt during the time that there were people that were asking the right questions, that were clearly setting out a perimeter, we thought, that would allow them to either bring in a not guilty or at least hang, in other words, be divided and not reach unanimity. But at the end, it just appeared that all that opposition that we saw just caved in. And in thinking about it, it just reminded me of some of my earlier studies politically, which talked about how in a democracy, people sometimes are willing to just cave in to Big Brother. And in the time of fear, which this certainly is, to say, I'll believe whatever the government says because that's the safest way to be. The women, three of the women on the jury wept during the entire rendition of the verdict. Why were they weeping if they thought they had done justice? You only can say that somehow they knew they hadn't, but felt that they had to bring in this verdict, which was asked of them by the government lawyers.
And Michael Tiger, where does the case go from here? There's a July 15th sentencing. Will you be appealing before then, or you'll be waiting for the actual sentence and then begin an appeal process? Or?
3 weeks from yesterday, we will file post-trial motions analyzing some of the legal issues and evidentiary issues for Judge Codall to rule on. If he denies those motions, then the sentencing will go forward on July 15th, and after that, an appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and on beyond. So we are less than halfway, let us say, through this very long struggle in the legal system.
We want to ask you about exactly what the charges are and the implications of this. And, of course, bring in Attorney General Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney Ramsey Clark, to talk about the significance of this. Also, we'll talk about the fact that you were both the lawyers for Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman and the difference or the similarities in how you dealt with him. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with our guests in a minute. Trees by Max Richter here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 300 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS, as well as both satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and we are closed captioned for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue to talk about the verdict yesterday in New York courtroom, the verdict against the three defendants charged with terror-related crimes. Our guests are Lynn Stewart, found guilty on all five counts of aiding terrorists and lying to the government in a case that has reverberated with, among others, defense attorneys around the country. Our guests are Lynn Stewart, her attorney Michael Tiger, and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Juan?
Well, Michael Tiger, for those who haven't been following the case closely, could you talk to us about specifically the charges that Lynn was found guilty of and also the other defendants?
Well, count one was a conspiracy to defraud the United States. Basically, the allegation was that Lynn, Mr. Sitar, Mr. Yousry, evaded so-called special administrative measures, which the Department of Justice Bureau of Prisons imposes to restrict, shut off communication between prisoners and the outside world. And that they did that in Lynn's case by issuing one and only one statement to Reuters, a public press release, and clarifying it 2 days later. So as far as messages, plural, are concerned, there's one message, and it was proven not to have any effect. But that's the conspiracy to defraud. Because Lynn agreed to abide by the special administrative measures, it was said that those agreements constituted false promises or false statements. That's count six and seven. Sitar was charged separately in count two with a conspiracy to kill or kidnap persons in a foreign country.
He's the Staten Island postal worker.
He had many, many conversations in Arabic with people in Egypt. In Mr. Sitar's defense, it should be pointed out that we said, well, what country was the kidnapping going to take place in? And the judge said, well, you don't have to tell them. Well, who is going to get murdered? Well, you don't have to tell them. So this is an unknown possible kidnapping in a possible foreign country done by weapons that were never produced in court. There are weapons of destruction in Egypt, said the Bush administration, but it never produced any. It's getting to be a pattern. He was convicted of that. Then Sattar was convicted of his telephone solicitations when calls back and forth to Egypt and Afghanistan of crimes of violence. Lynn was convicted of conspiring to prepare to assist Sattar's conspiracy. And with actually preparing to assist Sattar's conspiracy, the judge rejected the idea that so-called multiple inchoate crimes does pose some danger to freedom of expression, as well as being unheard of in American law. And once again, Lynn's alleged participation in that consisted of this one and only one statement. And I need to correct something. Terrorism is not an element of any of the offenses with which Lynn Stewart was charged. The terror label appears in the catch line of one of the statutes. It's not an element, and yet you can see how successful the Bush administration has been at pasting the terrorism label on these non-events so closely, so clearly, that everybody kind of assumes it and it becomes a part of discourse, which is, of course, the difficulty in a trial like this. As Lynn said in one of your video clips, if you mention Osama bin Laden's name, you don't have to present any evidence. You can tell the jury that he has nothing to do with the case. But there's been this discourse, this drumbeat, that makes it very difficult for our voice to be heard.
Is it fair to say Lynn was convicted on two counts of conspiring to commit murder in Egypt?
No. Sattar was convicted of conspiring to commit murder in Egypt. Lynn was charged with conspiring to prepare to assist him to commit the murders in Egypt. And the only thing she did in order to do that was to issue this one public statement, which said, I withdraw my support for the ceasefire. Well, by the way, don't cancel it. That just happens to be my opinion.
Now, let's talk about that statement, what you're referring to. Explain exactly what the statement of Lynn Stewart, why don't you explain, of your client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, that you are charged with taking out of the prison and letting the world know about?
Well, of course, it was no surprise to them. They didn't learn about this by their secret surveillance tapes in the prison. This was publicly done, openly done. Reuters, of course, is a well-known international news gathering agency. They were called. They were read a press release that had been dictated to the Arabic interpreter by the Sheikh. It basically said that his personal support of the ceasefire was being withdrawn. But he went on to say, I want you to discuss it. You are the people on the ground. I am not there. I would like to escalate in the media, because the group had also stopped talking critically about the Egyptian government. So it contained all those elements. When the news broke and it became Sheikh urges withdrawal from the ceasefire, we issued a second press release, which we spoke to him on the phone, and he gave us the authorization to do, which said basically, I am not withdrawing my support of the ceasefire. I am merely questioning it, and I am urging you who are on the ground there to discuss it and to include everyone in your discussions, as we always have done.
Now, what about these releases? The government has said that you signed certain agreements in taking the case that you would abide by the regulations that they established, and to some degree, they made a big deal in the trial itself about you openly flouting the agreements that you had agreed to, that you had signed beforehand.
You see, we operated, and my colleague Ramsey here and Abdin Jabara, we operated with an understanding that the government knew we had to do the legal work. And to do the legal work, that was permissible, even though the SAMs on the face of them might seem to say we couldn't do it, because we had done it. And this was not a first time. This was many years. We had been under the SAMs since 97.
The SAMs standing for?
These prison regulations.
Special administrative measures.
That regulated the Sheikh's ability to speak to the outside world. But it was understood that there were certain things legally that needed to be done, and our entire goal at that point was to keep him alive on the world scene so that we could negotiate something, something that would be good for this country and also for him.
Ramsey Clark, you're the former U.S. Attorney General. You were brought into this trial because you, too, had been one of the lawyers for Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. Can you first respond overall to the verdict?
Well, it's clear that Len Stewart and the truth and the Constitution of the United States are all victims of 9/11 and of a repressive government that's taking advantage of the fear that they have helped create arising from that, that is destroying freedom in this country.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. This case would never have been brought except for the fear generated and the advantage that the Bush administration was taking of it by the events on September the 11th of 2001. In ordinary times and circumstances, it would be recognized that everything that Len did was exactly what an effective attorney representing a client zealously would be obligated to do.
Now, the prosecution used you in the trial to say you, too, represented the sheikh. You signed off on the SAMs, on the special administrative measures, and you abided by them. You didn't put out information about that Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman was trying to get out, they allege, though Michael Tiger is shaking his head. They used you to show a contrast. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know why you say they used me. It was the defense that called me,
yeah.
Not the prosecution.
Right, but when
I would
they
never been
cross-examined
in that courtroom
you.
Except,
when they
the prosecution request, because they didn't want me there. And it's simply not true. I don't know of anything that Lynn did that I didn't do. We did what we had to do to represent our clients. And if you don't do that, then you don't have truth before the jury or before the public, and you don't have a constitutional right to the assistance of counsel.
And I was shaking my head because, in fact, Ramsey did come as a defense witness, and the defense put in public statement after public statement that Ramsey had issued in the sheikh's name over time, that the government, in fact, in one letter acknowledged violated the SAMs and then later went back on it. I dwelled on that in summation and said, well, we said it did, but it didn't. And they never could defend the idea that they hadn't gone after Ramsey, not suggesting that they would. But Ramsey Clark set an example here. Because he didn't, you know, he didn't have to come to court and stand up for Lynn, but he did it. And it shows that this case really is a threat to all the lawyers who are out there attempting to represent people that face these terrible consequences. You know, Ms. Goodman, you and I were talking before. The only way that we will ever get to the bottom of the American concentration camp abuses at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib is if the lawyers for these prisoners are permitted to tell their stories to the world. If the government can shut off that communication, which they have attempted to do over and over and over again, these activities will continue in secret, blessed as they are, by the highest officials of government in a country which has, for the first time in its history, given a cabinet job to a fellow who says that the Geneva Convention is obsolete and that the torture norm doesn't mean anything.
So would you say... Sorry, Juan.
No, so what about the impact, then, on other lawyers who take up these cases? And in what particular ways will this verdict affect their ability to properly represent their clients?
Every lawyer who wants to represent somebody at Guantanamo, every lawyer who wants to represent somebody being held by the United States under these conditions of detention is now being asked to sign various agreements. I agree my meetings won't be confidential. I agree I'll do this. I'll agree I'll do that. All of which limit the lawyer's ability to function as a lawyer. Lawyers are battling against these restrictions. From time to time, some of them may feel that, as a matter of interpretation, as Lynn did, in good faith, this can't possibly mean I can't do this. And it's that threat that they face. It is the chilling effect on a profession, only a minority of whose members are willing to shoulder the obligation to represent the oppressed that is at stake here.
And what about this issue of the government being able basically to eavesdrop on all conversations between a lawyer and a client? What does has that been tested itself in the courts, just the fact that basically the government has total access to the strategy and the deliberations of a client and a lawyer?
Well, it will be tested again in this case, of course, but the Patriot Act, an attorney general provision, that the authorization can come from the Attorney General of the United States and not even by a judicial warrant, that has yet to be tested in the courts of the United States. And this is not only a matter of the American Constitution. The European Court of Human Rights has long held that any interference with confidential lawyer-client communication violates principles of human rights that are happen to be embodied in the European Convention, but are principles of peremptory international law.
And just speaking on behalf of the defense, the fear to me is not the people who will say, no, I won't do those cases, which may also be an outgrowth of it, but the people who will do the cases but will now do them with an eye over their shoulder to make sure they are doing it the way the government thinks the case should be done. In other words, no challenge, no client-centered defense will take place if you're thinking all the time, what am I going to do if they indict me like they did Lynn Stewart?
Michael Tiger, are you suggesting the SAMs themselves are unconstitutional? I mean, when you make that point about lawyers, for example, going to Guantanamo, and they get word out about what's happening to their clients, if the government says you can't say this, that's in effect what they were saying here, that you could not send a message out what your client had to say. Do you think that the SAMs should be challenged themselves?
We have challenged the SAMs as a part of this trial. Yes, these SAMs raise constitutional issues. But beyond that, Lynn Stewart recognized that these SAMs needed to be interpreted in a way that permitted the lawyers to do their job. That is, when you're faced with a document as a lawyer, she needs to go and see her client. She's got two choices. She can say, this is unconstitutional. I will sue the United States of America. And 4 years from now, maybe I will be able to see my client. Or she can take the document in hand and say, let's meet, let's be a good lawyer, let's see if we can read this document in a way that says we get to do our job, we'll interpret it as being in conformity with the Constitution, and we'll do it. That way you can go see your client right now. And that had been the modus vivendi. And in fact, when Pat Fitzgerald, the assistant U.S. attorney, said, well, you're not interpreting it correctly, he wrote her a letter way back in 2000. He said, you know what we're going to do to you? You're not going to be able to see your client until we get this straightened out. Nobody ever imagined until George Bush became president and John Ashcroft attorney general that these kinds of consequences would be poured down on a lawyer.
And now Pat Fitzgerald is the man now in Chicago who is in charge of, for John Ashcroft, chosen by John Ashcroft, investigating who outed Valerie Plame.
Yes, that the fox has been placed in charge of a different hen house.
And Ramsey Clark, again about the impact on other lawyers across the country. Do you agree that this is going to have a chilling effect on their ability to continue to represent clients, especially in high-profile cases of this kind?
Well, I think the good lawyers and courageous lawyers will be inspired by Lynn's example and follow it. I think freedom in this society depends on that side of that type of courage and commitment. Lynn is an enormously courageous and brilliant lawyer, but more than that, she's a loving person, and she loves this country too. And she did what is best for it, and she's right. And history, and perhaps we hope the courts, will vindicate her.
Alberto Gonzalez, who has the position you once held, Attorney General, said right after the convictions, they, quote, send a clear, unmistakable message that this department will pursue both those who carry out acts of terrorism and those who assist them with their murderous goals. Your response?
Well, it's what we've had for the last several years, since 9/11. And if they pursue that and continue as they have to succeed, convicting many innocent people, including Lynn Stewart, then the country's going to be in real danger. They've terrified Arab American Muslims throughout the United States, and they've terrified people who believe that you have to stand up and speak the truth when it's important to the survival of this country.
Michael Tiger, in 3 weeks you go back to court. In this call for dismissal, are you asking the judge to set aside the verdict?
Yes.
The judge?
The judge.
How does that work? I mean, a jury has spoken.
We have the right to ask for three things. First, for a judgment of acquittal, notwithstanding the jury's verdict. The judge, we moved for that at the end of the government's evidence and again at the end of all the evidence. And the judge took the unusual step of reserving decision on that. The second thing is we can ask for a new trial on the ground that the joinder of these three defendants together made it impossible to get a fair trial, that some of this inflammatory evidence should never have been received. And third, we can raise the constitutional issues, most of which we raised and were rejected or are accepted to some extent before the trial. So those are the standard post-trial motions that are made in every federal criminal case. One of the great things about the Constitution is that you're supposed to have this way of having independent review by an Article III judge of the legal issues, so that if by chance a jury verdict gets carried into the wrong territory by passion or prejudice, that there, something can be done about it.
And Lynn, of course, one of the aside from the conviction itself, certainly one thing that must sting the greatest is the fact that as a result of the conviction, you've now been automatically disbarred. And after years and decades of representing all kinds of clients that the government obviously didn't want you to represent, and I think back to the Larry Davis case and the Attica case and all of these other tremendous victories that you had against the government. So certainly there are more than a few prosecutors in New York and across the country that are saying, finally, we were able to silence Lynn Stewart. Your sense of your reflection on that?
Well, that is my greatest sense of loss, that I will be cut off from this profession that I love and that I feel that I have served, and I have served people who had no voice. I have cases pending now that will now have a new lawyer who will be undoubtedly my son, who practices law with me and also has a sense of justice and is a brilliant lawyer. But it's, to me personally, not to be in the courts, not to be fighting these cases, will be a tremendous loss. I can't describe that. That is the most profound part of this for me.
I want to go back to the question you were asked yesterday outside the courthouse. Would you do this again? You say it all comes down to this piece of paper, this one press release that went out for the sheikh announcing he wasn't supporting the ceasefire anymore. What would you do now?
You know, it wasn't a decision that was just made off the cuff. We thought about this for a while before we made the press release, and it was considered that it was important to him, considered important to our handling of the case, that this press release be made to keep him a figure on the world stage. If he had lost that, we would not have any bargaining power. We would not be able to do anything that would move him from this really torturous situation in which he was being held, a blind, sick man who did not speak any English. And so that decision was made and it was considered. Of course, I had no notion of this kind of consequence. Actually, these prison regulations, these SAMs said, you know, if you break these regulations, you may be cut off from your client. That was our greatest concern, that we would be cut off from the client. The idea of prosecution never entered our minds. But the fact of the matter is, even with what has happened, it was the right decision. You can't start saying, well, maybe I'll do this, but I won't do that. It has to be that within the rules of ethics, what vigorously and zealously defending a client means, you carry through on it, you do so wholeheartedly. I believe with my mind and heart that it was the right thing to do. I don't like the consequences. I feel for the people who care so much about me personally, and the terrible destruction that has wrought. But I do feel that it was the right thing to do, and that that is what we do. I think Ramsey said it very well on the witness stand. It was the right thing to do for the client.
You know, this is we're in New York now, broadcasting. Chambers Street is down the road there, and there's a Delancey Street. Do you know where those come from? There was a lawyer named Chambers and a lawyer named Smith who were struck from the rolls of the Bar of New York for courageously representing the colonial newspaper editor John Peter Zenger in 1735 in this town. Andrew Hamilton came to town and defended him and got him acquitted. The judge that did it was Judge Delancey, who also has a street named after him. But I understand he mended his ways after he behaved so badly at the trial. So Lynn Stewart stands in a great tradition in this part of the city.
And, of course, your trial took place in the courtroom of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
Yes, and we, unlike the Rosenbergs, have gotten tremendous support. At least the movement itself recognizes the case as being part of a greater issue, bigger than just the lawyer. It is part of the constitutional crisis that is really facing the country right now. And yesterday afternoon when that verdict was rendered, that courtroom was packed. There was no place to sit down. It was not the empty courtroom the Rosenbergs faced many times.
And for those who would like to continue supporting your efforts from across the country who are listening to this show or watching it, where can they contact?
Well, the website will be up and running, lynnstewart.org, two N's and an E on the Lynn, and we intend to keep on fighting, to speak out, to organize, to bring this to people, and to ask people to come with us on this. We're, of course, at this date, we have no concrete plan, but we know that that's what's important, to speak out and to not be afraid and to stand up for what's right.
Finally, in terms of the years you face in prison, if the judge doesn't dismiss the charges in a few weeks, the numbers have been conflicting. Can you clarify? We hear 20, we hear 30, we hear up to 40.
Right. Well, Amy, you know, I'm 65. I've just begun to collect my Social Security. It probably is a moot point, as some of my clients would say. That is, whatever the time is, it's probably going to be too much. But I think the number is 45 would be a maximum. We have very little doubt that the government will continue its ways, ask for an extra enhancement based on the terrorism connections, all of these things. But we are going to fight that in due course. And if I have to go to jail, I noticed that yesterday, the day I was convicted, was the same day that Nelson Mandela walked out of prison. And he did 27 years, and we can name so many people that had to do time before they came to the revolutionary moment. So for that reason, whatever it has to be, it has to be. We're going to fight it all the way, and we're going to organize as we go.
And also on the July 15th sentence date, once the judge sentences on that date, and let's assuming you appeal, would she automatically begin to have to serve the time then, or would they?
No, certainly not automatically. The government agreed she would remain out on bail pending the sentencing, and we have good reason to believe that we can continue that good argument for Lynn to be out pending appeal. But let's not underestimate. The Supreme Court declared the sentencing guidelines unconstitutional. That's one of the reasons we're having the trouble, you know, about how many years. Is it 35 or 45? That means that unlike the guideline situation, this judge has the power to give Lynn Stewart probation. And one of the things the movement needs to organize around is to make this judge understand that this is somebody who does not belong in a federal prison. And if you, there'll be a lot about that on the website, because communications with the court are possible. They should be sent to an address that you'll find there in a few days, and then they can be forwarded to the court as a part of the sentencing hearing. This sentencing is not just going to be walk in, find out, and walk back out. We're going to fill the courtroom again, and we're going to have a hearing, and we're going to have witnesses, and we'll see where it goes.
And that website is
lynnstewart.org.
I want to thank you both for joining us, Lynn Stewart, your attorney, Michael Tiger, and Ramsey Clark. We'd like to ask for you to stay on for the next segment as we talk about another case that a verdict came down in yesterday of an Iraqi-American doctor from upstate New York convicted of violating the sanctions imposed against Iraq before the U.S. invaded. I want to thank you both for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Marcel Khalife, Children and the Wolf, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Now to a case that's received very little attention. Iraqi-American Dr. Rafil Dafir was found guilty yesterday of violating economic sanctions against Iraq. The U.S. government alleged Dr. Dafir illegally raised millions of dollars and violated U.S. sanctions by sending funds to Iraq through his charity called Help the Needy. When Dr. Dafir was apprehended in February of 2003, Attorney General John Ashcroft talked about the arrest as part of President Bush's war on terror. But terrorism charges were never brought against Dr. Dafir. Instead, he was indicted on 60 charges, including violating economic sanctions, Medicare fraud, and tax evasion. Dr. Dafir has been found guilty on 59 of those counts and is apparently the only U.S. citizen to have ever been convicted of breaking economic sanctions against Iraq. We're joined now by Joel Cohen, Dr. Dafir's attorney. Juan?
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Juan.
Tell us a little bit about the case and the unusual situation, because obviously there have been many folks like, as such as Voices in the Wilderness, who have been involved in breaking the sanctions with Iraq before the U.S. invasion, and no one yet has been prosecuted there.
Well, that's accurate. Dr. Dafir was clearly targeted, clearly investigated, clearly indicted, tried, and clearly convicted because he is a Muslim, because he is a person of Iraqi ancestry. And as you pointed out, he's the only person that's been criminally charged with violating these sanctions.
And what specifically was he involved in doing with the charity?
Well, he and some other folks in the early 90s, when the impact of the sanctions really began to devastate the Iraqi infrastructure, when it destroyed the health system, when it increased the infant mortality rate tenfold and the rate of cancer tenfold, because not only did the folks in Iraq have to deal with the impact of the sanctions, but also of the devastation wrought by the Gulf War, the depleted uranium that remained behind and so seriously hurt the health system in Iraq. He and some other folks got together and began to raise money and to seek to get funds, humanitarian aid, food, blankets, medicine, into Iraq. People at Help the Needy were aware that dealing with any government institution involved in distribution of aid in Iraq, which means any Iraqi government institution, meant that whatever aid actually reached the country went into the pockets of the regime. So they sought to establish a network of people in the Middle East that could raise funds, purchase things in Jordan and other countries, and try to get them into Iraq in such a way that they would reach the people that needed them and not the folks in the regime.
Mohammed Khatter is also on the line with us, a friend of Dr. Dafir's for two decades. The reaction in the Muslim community and also of Dr. Dafir's family.
Well, the reaction in the Muslim community, we've been in shock and disbelief that something like this can happen. We never expected that the doctor will be convicted on 59 counts. It just goes to say that we as Muslims we are being held to higher standards than any other citizen in this country. We have to prove our innocence beyond any reasonable doubt, not the other way around. And for the doctor to be convicted this way, it just goes to say that any Muslim is difficult to get a fair trial in this environment.
Ramsey Clark, your response. You are familiar with this case in Syracuse, New York.
You know, I went up to Syracuse and spoke on a university campus for the defense in this case, and the place was jammed with people from the community, 1,500 people there, perhaps. And they all wanted to know, why are they prosecuting this good doctor? What did he do? He cared about the suffering in Iraq. 1.5 million people died from those sanctions. More than half were children under the age of 5. What did they need? They needed medicine. What is he? He's a doctor. When the cancer rate started jumping, he's an oncologist because of the depleted uranium, which is spread throughout the country from the U.S. assault on Iraq. It was tearing him up, so he was trying to help in a humanitarian cause. When a tsunami occurs, when there are natural disasters occur, you try to help. And sanctions are more deadly than those by far. So what he was doing was what every human being who cares about life ought to do. And the prosecution of him has threatened not only the Arab American and the Muslim American communities, which are vast, but it threatens anyone who stands up for doing the right thing in a crisis.
The double standards here, not just the situation of prosecuting him for giving humanitarian aid, but then also the fact that the voices in the wilderness, other groups in the United States have also done the same thing. And also then you've got situations in the United Nations under the Oil for Food Program where nations were violating the sanctions and the United States was winking, looking the other way while these violations of sanctions were going on.
Well, there's one thing you have to understand here, and that is that this case began as a terrorist investigation. The government saw at some point that funds were being sent to Jordan, sent to a bank in Jordan, and every document in the case, every government memorandum, they brought the Defense Department into this investigative team. They had every single federal law enforcement agency here but the Fish and Wildlife Commission forming a task force to investigate the doctor, and all of it was a search for a connection to terrorism. They just couldn't believe that these folks were simply trying to feed people that were starving and heal people that were sick.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Joel Cohen, Mohammed Khatter, and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark in our studio. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Be in Phoenix tonight, Arizona. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, and tomorrow night at 6 in Olympia, Washington at Evergreen College. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.